great teaching happens when teachers get time to think. Walk into an Educate classroom and you'll find a consistent approach to homework, teachers who know where knowledge gaps are, and students who are doing regular retrieval practice. With Educate, you can be free from marking homework by the end of the week. Students have now answered over 1 billion questions on Educate. If you're looking to set up centralised homework and revision in your geography department, you won't be disappointed. Your first month is free at www.educate.co.uk/geography.
Hello there, welcome to JogPod. Today, my guests are Catherine Balcom, Luke Hinchcliffe, and John Hopkin. Catherine, you're subject lead at Westminster City School. You've been involved in a number of publications, actually, about planning for progression. Two of them with David Gardner, who I've worked with. Luke, you're been head of department for 2 years in Hertfordshire. And for that, sadly, the only geographer in the school, which is always very tricky. It's hard to have a meeting with yourself. And John, who probably doesn't need very much introduction to anyone who's had anything to do with the GA for the last 50 years. You're ex-president of the Geographical Association, that was 2010 to 2011. You're an author of too many books to list, really. And you're a teacher, senior leader, advisor, and now consultant. Welcome all. Thanks for joining me today on JogPod. We couldn't be in better hands today, really, because the theme of today's podcast is we're going to be talking about progression. We're going to be talking about what it means to make progress specifically in geography, and also how we know that our pupils are making that progress. You're all members of the Geographical Association's Assessment and Examination Special Interest Group, which is the group really that holds this as one of its main priorities. So before we talk about you, I'd like to just ask you a little bit about the group itself, because I'm not sure how many teachers are aware of what it does and what the aim of that group is. John, if I can start with you first.
Okay, thanks, John. Yeah, I've been a member of the group since the 1990s, really. I'm the kind of veteran of the group now. And our purpose really has been to advise members on all matters in relation to exams and assessment. And we do that in a number of ways. We monitor, for example, the examination process. We provide a yearly update of grades for GCSE and A-level. We keep an eye on specifications, but also particularly in relation to the national curriculum, we do quite a lot of work on assessment and advising members about the assessment system and assessment processes. So that's our kind of brief. We also try to do a publication pretty much every year in teaching geography or primary geography. We usually hold a workshop at the conference. Catherine's doing that this year. And as I said, we publish that exam results summary every year. So it keeps us busy. And then we also have kind of long-term projects like our recent guidance on progression and assessment.
Catherine, John's mentioned that you're involved in conference. What influenced you to become part of the special interest group?
I think for me, I took over as a subject leader in my school about 3 years ago. So I've been at my current school for 7 years and it's undergone quite a lot of change in that time period. I think for me, I was really interested and drawn in by the fact that the group is a mixture of kind of ex-teachers and non-teachers, but also teachers who are currently in the classroom. So I think for me, somebody who is a subject leader kind of going through the process of overhauling our curriculum and trying to make it more fit for purpose, I was really interested in getting more in touch with the theory and sort of benefiting from the work that's going on within the special interest group to kind of promote progression and assessment as a really important part of kind of curriculum design. Ultimately, I wanted the best outcome for my students, and I thought it was a really nice opportunity to get more involved in my subject community. I think I've seen the GA special interest groups for a number of years at the conference, either leading sessions or with stands at the conference. And I have to be honest, before I joined the group, I didn't really know much about what the special interest groups did. So for me, I wanted to get more involved in that process and to kind of see that sort of framework that we've got within the GA for collaboration to really push forward and work together towards achieving best practice in this area.
Was it conference really that drove your interest in the group? Is that where it developed first?
Absolutely. I've seen, like I said, I've seen different conference sessions delivered by different special interest groups, and I think I really wanted to explore that more. And I think the way particularly the assessment and examination group is formed, like I said, of teachers and non-teachers, I think that's a really special thing that we can really capitalise on that experience that we've got within the group. You know, different people I've met at the conference who've been part of the group for a long time, like John, like we said, but also kind of having newer members and sort of bringing fresh ideas to it. I think that was what really piqued my interest in the first instance.
How did you find out about the group, Luke? What was your process that got you involved?
Pretty much the same as Catherine, which was just via conference, one of their sessions and then their stand at conference, and then went from there. And now I'm secretary, sort of having to put some sort of spin into the minutes of what everyone sort of thought, which at times can be challenging, especially with how much we go through in just a meeting about assessment and examination.
How long have you been a member?
Probably been a member for 3 years. My memory's fading.
Has it affected your teaching a lot, do you think?
It's definitely made me more curious about the different types of assessments we can use perhaps in a classroom and to assess progress over time, and perhaps drawn into different thinking about how we measure the progress students make.
What about you, Catherine? Do you think it's made a difference to your teaching?
It absolutely has. Like I said, I inherited a department where our curriculum definitely needed a huge overhaul in terms of making sure that progress was at the heart of the way that we sequenced our curriculum and sort of drawing on the latest theories to do with curriculum and assessment and what supports students to make better progress in geography. So for me, I think being part of the group has really informed the way that I teach. It's informed the way that I design my curriculum, but it's also kind of really helped me to align with the kind of importance of progression being at the heart of any kind of curriculum framework that we deliver in schools. And I think it's really made me step back and reflect on that as a practitioner and to ensure that progress is at the heart of everything that I do.
Well, following on from that, Catherine, I think one of the key major pieces of work that the SIG's been recently engaged in is the development and launch of the progression assessment guidance, given what you've been saying about how important it is to you as a teacher. I think this is a seminal piece of work, but I'm interested, John, to ask you why the group considered there was a need for such guidance now.
Yeah, it's partly stretching right back through geography in the national curriculum, which doesn't mean the guidance is only for teachers in England or indeed in the UK. It's meant to be general advice and support. But it is the case that the quality of assessment has been an enduring difficulty for geography teachers at all key stages, and successive subject inspection reports have picked that up. So one of the group's core purposes has been to try and offer support and guidance for members to try and help them see their way through that. In part, it's the structure of geography, which is a complex subject, I think probably more so than history. In part also, it's the way that schools take decisions, sometimes based on their own circumstances, obviously, but sometimes in ways which don't seem to help people at the departmental level. So our task really has been to try and unpick what assessment's about and then put back together a kind of framework or guidance to help people make their own decisions within a kind of structure which makes sense for geography and geography education, but hopefully makes sense for them as well. So as I say, it's been for several versions now, and the early versions were very much focused on assessment processes and practices, and the later ones, we turned it round really to focus more on progression with assessment guidance there in support. And the last thing to mention is it's designed to link in with other work going on in the association, for example, in relation to the new curriculum framework and thinking about concepts in geography. and also to other JA work like David Gardner's guidance on building the curriculum. So that's where it's come from anyway.
I was looking at this as I was reading up, and the language of the school inspectorate is often that the curriculum is the progression model. You've just illustrated why it's so difficult for geographers, because geography is much more complex than a very briefly written curriculum, I think. And Luke, when we were talking earlier, you made a comment about there's no perfect or preferred curriculum progression model, because the nature of geography means the curriculum always be varied by context and location. So different schools may want to promote different elements to create a better curriculum for them.
Yeah, definitely. Basically, I've been around in terms of schools. I've been in inner London and then I've moved out of London. And a really good example will be the ideas around migration. In inner London, it's sort of more understood because of perhaps context of the children you have in your classrooms, backgrounds, the diversity of London. Whereas when you move out of London, and perhaps when I was teaching up north, actually that idea of the migration debate was completely different. There's a different context to it, and therefore how you had to teach it is different. You have to perhaps reframe some of the ideas that we're talking about. So for a lot of kids perhaps that I've taught outside of London, the idea of economic migration wasn't sort of as much as asylum seekers and illegal migration. And actually, when you put it into context to them, it reframes perhaps how they see the world. And that's the great perhaps power in terms of teaching geography. You can reframe how they're seeing the world by giving them reliable sources of information rather than perhaps what they're picking up from home, the web, the newspapers, social media.
Catherine, presumably your curriculum followed the national curriculum, but like Luke's just said, it was inappropriate in other ways as well.
Yeah, so the issue I had with, if you look at my Key Stage 3 curriculum, the main issue I had is that the learning wasn't sequenced in order to support pupils to make maximum progress. I'll give you an example from my Year 7 curriculum. We started off, as many schools I'm sure do, with a unit on map skills. So ordnance survey maps, looking at map symbols, looking at how to interpret physical and human landscapes using maps. The issue we then had is that looking at the other units that then followed throughout the whole of our Key Stage 3 curriculum, those skills were not revisited, they weren't built on, and they weren't necessarily developed in the units that followed. So what we found is that students, when they got to GCSE, lacked the fundamental skills to be able to kind of perform well on those map skills questions that required them to use kind of sources to be able to interpret different landscapes. So that was kind of the first issue. But then if you look at kind of our Year 7 curriculum in more depth, from map skills, we went on to tectonics, and from there we went on to Africa. Now, the main issue with having a regional unit so early on in a Year 7 curriculum is that our students lacked the conceptual understanding of a lot of the building blocks of our subject to make sense of the context of Africa, and that the fact that it's a diverse landscape with lots of different human and physical processes. So what we found is that we had units about economies, units about biomes and ecosystems that came later in the Key Stage that students would have benefited from having studied before they then looked at Africa as a regional context through which to make sense of all those different ideas in one kind of geographical location. So the sequencing of our units really weren't set up well to kind of support students for success. Another example is we studied ecosystems in Year 8 before we then looked at weather and climate. And if you look at that, obviously students need to understand that weather and climate influences where biomes are located on the Earth's surface and where our ecosystems are. And I think kind of the sequencing of that knowledge wasn't correct, and therefore as a result our students weren't able to make that progress in terms of linking together human and physical processes and ultimately kind of make those interconnections that are so fundamental to progress in our subject.
It's interesting because when I first started teaching, we had very much the same in the department that I started working at. We did Under the Southern Cross in what we call the second year, but Year 8. We did local geography in Year 7. We did Under the Southern Cross, so African countries and a little bit of, we didn't even touch Australia, but it was very regional geography. And we learned a little bit about Egypt and fellaheen using the Shadoof. And then the third year, we went into regional geography of Europe. There was no sequencing. This was pre-national curriculum, of course, but I ended up using a Norman Graves, the GA's Geography and Secondary Education publication, that was 1979. And he looked at the same sorts of issues even then in 1979. So your department and many others don't look as though they've come much further since. I've spent a fair bit of time talking to David when he was putting his ideas together for progression in geography. And we visited a number of schools where that idea of progression was sort of assumed rather than written, I think.
Yeah, I think that is what the phrase, the curriculum is your progression model, means. I think it means that progression's not going to happen automatically. You've got to plan for it. And as Catherine's indicated, plan for it very carefully. And she mentioned a couple of examples, really, which obviously in her school now a strength, but in many schools a weakness. One is geographical skills, often underplayed, undervalued, and hence when students get to their GCSE exams, it's an area they perform poorly on. That's been an issue right through the national curriculum. If you look back at Ofsted reports going back nearly 30 years now, that's consistently an issue for schools and remains so. The other one I pick out is places. Places often really rather poorly taught, but it is very much part of thinking about progression. There's some work which looks at places as an integrated whole, not just at the themes. And the last thing I'm going to highlight as an opportunity is thinking about some of the big themes of geography, climate change being an obvious one, and thinking very carefully how you're going to thread that through a number of units so that by the time students reach the end of year nine, they're really pretty well informed about that and they just haven't had a sort of short burst of it somewhere along the way.
Many writers I've been looking at talk about the concepts are the centrepiece of geographical education. So what was the thought processes that went behind developing the concepts that underpin the various elements of your teaching? And Catherine, one of the first things that you did was think about the core organising concepts.
Absolutely. I think when you take over as a subject leader, it's really important to kind of have that establishment of what is your intent, and through your intent you should be kind of thinking about what the organizing concepts are that you plan to progress through your curriculum. And this is what's mentioned in the progression framework that we've put together as a special interest group, the kind of the importance of having a really strong statement of intent and a really strong vision for what you were trying to achieve. So the first thing I did is I sat down with my team and we talked about kind of what are the pillars of our subject, what are the things that we want to progress through our curriculum in order to create the young geographers that we want to see by the time they finish either Key Stage 3, 4, or 5, depending on how long they choose to study it with us for. And that process was really interesting because we pulled out a lot of the things that come out of the literature on this subject, things like space and place, which won't be a surprise to many people, thinking about people and the environment, thinking about ideas like diversity, scale, change, interconnectedness, and sustainability. And those things really form the foundations of our vision statement or our statement of intent that we set out. And I can't underestimate the importance of this. When I was 2 months into post as a subject leader, we had the phone ring. Ofsted came in to do a deep dive of my department. And the very first question they asked me was, what is the thinking behind your curriculum? That was the question. And that's such an enormous question to tackle. But if you've really sat down and really got to grips with what are those core organizing concepts, it's really kind of easy to map that out. And it's really easy to explain what it is you're aiming for with a geographical education and how you then plan for progress in each of those kind of medium term, long term plans, and also kind of short term within a lesson sequence, for example, on all those different scales and timeframes. It's really easy to articulate that if you've put the time into thinking it through. And from that, it's then really obvious in what the children can do in lessons and what they're able to articulate that they are making progress in sort of joining those concepts together and understanding how different things interconnect.
It's interesting because you could go to a different school and space, place, people, that you would recognise that at every school, but it doesn't have to be that. The number of different academic writers who've come up with a different set of concepts or paired concepts that underpin geography. So Luke, what are the underpinning concepts that you work with? How far different are they from Catherine's?
I'd say largely similar because I've sort of gone for the progression framework as well. However, I'd say I've prioritised locational knowledge simply because we have got kids, when I first came in year 11, that didn't know the continents of the world. It's perhaps a very basic skill that they haven't had topped up and kept on top of throughout Key Stage 3, Key Stage 4. And they're reaching the end and they're being asked about a country or an exam case study for Asia, and they're talking about somewhere from South America. Similar things will apply, but the answer will get less credit. So it's sort of taking the context of the school you're in, understanding perhaps students. So again, a lot of the interdependence, interconnections, I've chosen to focus it on quite local examples, places they've been and seen, so that they can start to draw on those connections that they've seen, rather than going to a case study halfway around the world where they understand these sort of principles, but they're not necessarily fully understanding it. Like, a really good example is, we've got a massive Tesco's just up the road. Where's this stuff coming from? How's it getting here? All this globalization, trade, development, you can start to bring in. Are these farms getting a fair wage? What's their life like? Really local examples brought back that brings in such a big amount of geography that you can draw in throughout that sort of unit topic.
Can I just add into that? I think we had a very similar thought process in terms of how the local and global geographies kind of interconnect. And I think that's something that we work very carefully to kind of map to ensure that we were zooming in and out of those different scales. And I think that was a really interesting process for us in terms of how that intersected with those core concepts that we'd introduced. I think for us, our vision statement ended up being kind of centered on the fact that we wanted our students to kind of gain a better awareness and understanding of the world beyond their own doorstep. So starting off with the local geography and then using that as a platform to understand places that are a bit more distant and to kind of provide that context. So I think Luke and I, we have a very similar approach towards the thinking through our curriculum, in that it's really important to consider the local as a springboard for then planning for that progress and allowing students to interpret landscapes that are a bit more unfamiliar or a bit more distant. And I think for me, again, maybe it might be to do with the inner London location of our school. So my school is an inner city comprehensive school and it's all boys. And what we find is that a lot of our young people are quite sheltered in that they don't really know much about the world beyond their immediate vicinity. So for us, that's a huge thing in terms of our vision and our intent for geography, is how we can expand their view of the world and how we can equip them with the skills to then interpret those more distant landscapes. As Lucas hinted at, with saying kind of we need to start with the local geography in order to build up to something a bit more substantial in terms of a greater understanding of the interconnections that exist.
I know I've said this before, some people will say, oh, you've mentioned this on a podcast before, but I think perception of place is really key. And if you're doing perception of place and it's a local place, the idea of working with your children, your pupils, to understand that different people can have a different perception of that same place is a really important concept for them to grasp. Because then when you go to more distant places, they start asking questions about, what was the photographer trying to make us see when she took a photograph in that direction? How are they manipulating our sense of place? Is it the same for everyone who lives there? And I'm not sure that you can do that until pupils understand that their own place can be seen in different ways by different people and experienced in different ways. Catherine?
I think what's really interesting is that that's explicitly taught on a lot of A-level curriculum. So we do AQA, and as part of the Changing Places unit of work, sense of place, perception of place are a really kind of core fundamental ideas that underpin the understanding throughout that whole unit. I think where we find it interesting, given that we have all boys year 7 to 11, and then for our sixth form, we admit external students, which is a mixture of kind of boys and girls from elsewhere across London. And what we find is that our internal students who've been on that journey with us for 7 years and lived through our curriculum and have kind of seen that progression and those core ideas and those concepts, find it much easier to make a transition to understanding that in the context of A-level study, potentially compared to other students who may not have had those foundations in their curriculum previously. So I think it is something we've really explicitly tried to build in. We've also really worked hard to think about what misconceptions students might have about places. So when we teach a unit of work about Africa in our year 8 curriculum, and one of the first things we do is we look at what misconceptions might exist about the continent of Africa as an incredibly diverse continent with obviously many different countries, many different cultures, religions, etc., kind of coexisting alongside one another. And I think what we try to do is kind of break down those misconceptions and get the students to become critical thinkers who are critical about the world around them and question everything. And again, that's fundamental to our vision statement, and that's really a really important thing that we set out in our intent. So when I'm sitting and I'm curriculum planning with the other teachers in my department, we return to that vision statement as being fundamental to everything that we do. Are we building in opportunities to question the world? Are we building in opportunities for our young people to become critical thinkers? And that all adds up to kind of the skill development that we want to see that ultimately will prepare students for success at GCSE and A level, because they do have those fundamental core skills and they're using that and applying that in a range of different settings.
Catherine said something very interesting there, which is, although the work of the group is designed for teachers in all phases, actually a lot of the conversation is about secondary schools. And what Catherine's talking about is a curriculum model and thinking about progression that spans Key Stage 3, GCSE, and into A-level. So it's thinking forward, but she's also thinking back, in that there is the ground to be prepared for A-level in earlier years, just as there's the ground to be prepared for GCSE. And I think that's another aspect of the curriculum, is your progression model. Although all students won't be working their way through it, then some of them will, but there's no harm and great benefit in preparing students for some of those big ideas that they can develop properly later on.
I think it's also really important to recognise that Key Stage 2 geography also plays a huge part in that progression model. So we obviously get students coming in and joining our school at year 7 or in year 12, those two different touch points in our school community. Being a central London school, our catchment is the whole of London. So we can have young people that have come from, I don't know how many different feeder primary schools, but they will have all had a very different experience of what a geography education looks like at Key Stage 2. What we find is that a lot of our young people come to us with really quite specific knowledge about different areas of the world, but we also find that some of our young people can't necessarily identify compass points, or, as Luke said, they can't necessarily identify continents on a map when they arrive with us in year 7. So a huge piece of work that we did was broadening our sort of introductory unit of year 7 to not just be map skills, but be what is a geographer, and thinking about the skills of a geographer more fundamentally, and kind of thinking about how we could then build on that through Key Stage 3. And a huge part of that was understanding that what is the baseline, what's the kind of curriculum expectations of what a Key Stage 2 student should be able to do by the time they reach you. And in those first few weeks, really trying to get to grips with, have these young people met those kind of those learning outcomes? Are they ready to progress with their learning and embark on a Key Stage 3 curriculum? Or is there some work to be done to kind of level the playing field a bit and ensure that everybody is brought up to the same level and the same level of understanding? And I think that's something that the progression framework outlines really clearly, is the kind of curriculum expectations for what should be expected of a Key Stage 2 geographer, what our students should be able to do by the time they get to the end of Key Stage 3, at the end of year 9, and the same for Key Stage 4 and Key Stage 5. But us having a really clear understanding of what that tangibly looks like for our young people, what can they do, what should they know, and therefore are they ready to progress to the next phase, or do we need to take a step back and ensure that everyone's ready to move on?
Would that be the same for you, Luke?
Yes, I'd say so. But I'll also caveat by saying, actually, when you start going back and looking at perhaps primary school, actually, place is such an important concept in early years, foundation in Key Stage 1, when they're talking about where I live, the town I live in, what they see the world as. Primary schools might often get to do like sketch maps of where they live. They talk about, oh, and that's the shop, that's the street you take to the shop. There's actually so much sort of intuitive geographical knowledge they have already. And then we go to Key Stage 2, Key Stage 3, Key Stage 4, and we try to sort of systemize that knowledge into different strands of how we as geographers organise the world. Because actually, probably if you walk with a 3-4-year-old, they'll probably ask you questions like, why's the river there? Really simple questions that touch on so much geography. Now, as geographers, we then try and systemise, well, it's a bit to do with weather and climate, and a bit to do with geology, and a bit to do with how rivers work. But often those simple questions that they have at such a young age, we start trickling to a sort of systemized way of we learnt about geography. And that's sort of when that progression model goes in. It's taking those really simple ideas and going, how do we take that idea and progress that idea of, well, why is the river there? So that by the end, they can have a really complex answer or a really simple answer. So your Key Stage 1 might be a simple answer of, well, it rains lots of water, carries across the land, and it goes into the river. At A level, that's going to be all about stores and flows and infiltration rates and different types of geology. It's the same question, it's just vastly different answers. And I think that's a useful way of thinking about seeing where do you want those kids to be? Those simple questions of how would I expect kid in primary school to answer that to my year 9s, to my GCSEs, to people doing A level, to people doing degrees.
That brings us back to the complexity that we were talking about earlier, because it's not just about knowledge, it's about knowledge, it's about skills, it's about concepts. And unless you tie all those together, then young people don't make clear progress, I think it would be fair to say.
Yeah, so if I could come in there, one of the things the framework has tried to do is to try and make that simple and systematic. So the foundation really is these three aspects of achievement in geography: knowledge, understanding, and skills. And those run right through the curriculum from early years to A level, and clearly evident in the national curriculum aims and the exam specifications. And then having got those, as well as drilling right down to the objectives in most individual lessons. And then based on those, we plotted out how children might progress, for example, working with more complex information about places, increasing the range and capability with skills, working from concrete to abstract ideas, that sort of thing. And then, as Catherine mentioned, pulling those together, we have put together benchmarks of achievement to help schools to gauge students' achievement. So that's what the framework's all about, really.
Catherine, can you put that into a context for your school then? So you've used the framework. What does it look like in your department?
Well, like I said, we've tried to really clearly map out exactly kind of how each unit of work at Key Stage 3, for example, builds into what we would then expect a geographer to be able to do and the achievements we would expect them to have made by the point they get to the end of year 9, regardless of whether they go on to study GCSE or not. So if we're looking at the kind of the three strands that John mentioned, contextual knowledge, if we kind of map that really crudely onto GCSE, that's your first assessment objective, that's kind of knowledge of the world. If we're kind of looking at the second aspect of achievement in geography in terms of understanding, that's your AO2 at GCSE. So these things really do map really well onto each other. If we're looking at the aims and the assessment objectives for GCSE, these kind of key threads that John has mentioned really do map clearly onto that. And obviously the third strand as an aspect of achievement in geography in the progression framework is geographical inquiry. Now, inquiry is, I think, really fundamental. And I think it's something that we are still really working on in our curriculum, is kind of building in those opportunities to develop skills in terms of answering geographical questions and kind of inquiry-based learning, kind of building on the sort of principles of thinkers like Margaret Roberts in that area. So for us, we're trying really hard to think about kind of how can we make sure those three things are really well addressed in our curriculum, and how can we prove that students are making progress in those areas. So part of that is making sure that our assessments are fit for purpose, that any kind of summative assessment opportunities really do test those three things and allow us to gain a strong understanding of, have these children made progress in line with these kind of benchmark expectations at the end of each key stage, and kind of what does that look like for our learners. So that's assessment in sort of the summative sense, but also in the day-to-day assessment, how do teachers in the classroom formatively understand that students are making progress in these three areas. And in terms of the benchmarks, it's about using those descriptors of what do we expect a student to be able to do by the time they finish year 9, by the age of sort of 14, and kind of teachers being really clear on what that looks like in their classroom and ensuring they're building in those formative assessment opportunities to kind of to sense whether students are getting to making progress in that, to kind of see what more needs to be done to ensure that students have met those baseline expectations. It's kind of the goals that you're aiming for, I guess, at the end of each key stage. And it kind of underpins long-term, medium and short-term planning in the classroom for all.
The GA's programme of CPD is designed to support your teaching of geography, whatever your phase or career stage. We provide research-informed, accessible and convenient professional development alongside quality-assured presenters, many of whom are practicing teachers with strong track records of teaching and leading geography in their own schools. As a registered delegate, you'll get access to the recording of your course, as well as all of the resources, so that you can revisit key points and share ideas with other members of staff in your school. With subject knowledge updates for teachers of all key stages, courses that focus specifically on leading geography and developing your curriculum, and opportunities for integrating fieldwork, there's something for everyone. For further information or to view our current programme of events, please go to our website at geography.org.uk.
Luke, I've got two questions for you, really, because you're almost a one-man band and have been, so you don't have people to bounce ideas off. So two questions really rolled into one. How do you develop these ideas when you're on your own? Where else do you draw on from for your pure inspiration? And how different is it in your school, because you have a different set of students from Catherine?
So sort of the first question, it's actually really quite easy, because a lot of schools now, with all the Ofsted stuff, have curriculum intent, curriculum documents on their websites, and you can go and look, and you can start to look at their rationales of why they've done certain things the way they have. And you can look at certain things they're teaching and go, oh, that's interesting. Why are you teaching that there? So you've got that availability of lots of people's different interpretations of the curriculum. And some of them I wouldn't agree with personally, but it might work in that school in that context, and that's fine. Some of them I'm there going, actually, I really like that. And then when I start drilling down into it, I go, but actually it wouldn't quite work for where I am. And then it's like looking at other people's, and Twitter is an amazing thing, sorry, X now, but it is an amazing thing for sharing people's knowledge and understanding of everything. And there's lots of fantastic people on there that share really interesting ideas that you can go and take, and not necessarily staying in the echo chamber, some different perspectives as well in out there as well, that you can go and start looking at what you do and go, do we do that? Or do we do that enough? Or perhaps we do that too much? I think there is a whole range, and it's just about not accepting what we've got is okay. It's about, well, where is the next step? What are we going to do next? And I don't think you can ever stop doing that with your curriculum anymore. You can't just go, this is finished, this is perfect, because it probably isn't. And it's always about tweaking things or changing things or going, that unit isn't working. And that's perhaps where your assessment, your monitoring, your progress comes in, and going, well, that unit isn't working. Why is that unit not working? Is it in the wrong place? I.e., like Catherine's mentioned before, you haven't got the prerequisite knowledge taught, so therefore they can't understand what you're teaching in that topic. Is it a case of how we're teaching it? And then you can start to go back through this cycle. And I think it's figure two in the progress booklet is sort of the be-all, end-all guide of how you sort of think about your curriculum of, here's my aims at the start. And then we go through, we teach everything, and then we get to that report, and then we go back to the start again and go, well, that's what's happened. Has that worked? Well, yes, no. Then we start the whole process again. I think that's where we're at. And now I've forgotten what the second question was.
It was, how different was it in context of your school compared to what Catherine said about the way that she implemented it?
So in terms of implementation, I think there's lots of similarities. I'd say I've gone for a lot perhaps broader approach, because there is just me. So if I go for my 120 year sevens, everyone's doing this assessment. That's 120 of that assessment I need to mark. So it's about perhaps thinking about the different types of assessments we can give students as well. Could we do multiple choice questions, and that's assessing, do they know stuff? Are they hitting that knowledge? And that might be something quite key for perhaps year seven. Do they know the compass points? Do they know this continent if they got a picture of it on a map? But perhaps when we're looking at, good example, brownfield, greenfield, write me a newspaper article for this local scheme. What do you think? What are other people saying about it? And it gives you perhaps different types of assessments, but it's assessing those different ideas as well. So that report is going to touch more on that geographical understanding, that ability to inquire and think like a geographer, than perhaps just a simple multiple choice question will give you.
Catherine?
Yes.
How do you get your students to become more sophisticated in their thinking?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think, like you say, like we mentioned earlier, it comes a lot back down to this idea of inquiry-based learning. So being really confident that students have acquired the prior knowledge they need to be able to then interpret new information and kind of make sense of it. So Luke's just mentioned about multiple choice questions and things like that as kind of being a way to formatively assess. And actually, that's something that's been really transformative for us in our department. Is our school policy is that we have a do now activity, so a starter activity at the start of every lesson, which is designed to be a bit of a settler, but also is focusing on that metacognition, learning how to learn, identifying gaps in knowledge and kind of retrieval opportunities as well. So we've now introduced and piloted over the last couple of years a 7-question multiple choice quiz at the start of every single lesson for every single key stage. Now, some of those questions will be kind of easy entry, sort of true false, just to get all students being able to participate and kind of increase that participation level in the lesson content from the start. But some of those questions will be hinge questions that are my students able to move on with their level of knowledge because they've acquired the prior knowledge they need in order to access this. So unlike Luke, obviously I work in a slightly bigger department, only marginally bigger, there are three of us instead of one, but I need to be confident that the other teachers in my department know that their children have acquired what they need to be able to move forwards with their learning. So introducing that sort of as a department-wide initiative has been really transformative, especially as we've got maybe people teaching in our department who may not be subject specialists. I'm sure a lot of other schools may have that situation as well. So that has been really key to ensuring that students have the prior knowledge they need to move forwards. But in terms of things like inquiry-based learning, I'll give you an example. We've recently been teaching or introducing hot deserts at year 10. So thinking about the living world topic for the AQA GCSE. And I started off that particular unit of work with a photograph of the Western Desert, which is our case study in the USA. And there were two questions up on the screen. What are the opportunities for development in this landscape? And what challenges might there be if we tried to develop this landscape? And I wanted to see what the students already knew on this. So just through inquiry, just through those two questions, what do they already know? What can they apply just by looking at the photograph and using their prior knowledge? And it really, really surprised me that those students who've obviously gone through those latter stages of our key stage three in our new curriculum, in their partner discussions and in what they wrote down on their mini whiteboards, were saying things like, oh, we studied the Middle East last year. That was a hot desert environment. Now they got a lot of their water through aquifers. I wonder if there are aquifers in this landscape too that might make irrigation possible for agriculture. So just through a photograph, that sophistication of how they're then able to interpret that really simple piece of geographical information by drawing on prior knowledge. Now, this desert is obviously not in the Middle East. It's a very different context, but they were able to kind of draw on prior understanding to kind of make sense or kind of make some reasonable suggestions and inferences based on the information that they have. And I think that's been one of the most transformative impacts of our Key Stage 3 curriculum is those building blocks, both in a regional context and in terms of conceptual knowledge, our students have so much more of a foundation heading into GCSE to make sense of what we present them with. So what we're finding now is at GCSE, we're doing a lot more inquiry-based learning where we're presenting them with new information, getting them to do things like a layers of inference task with a photograph or a source, and they have to say, what do I know from this source? What can I infer? Or what further questions might I need to ask? And that's something that I know Margaret Roberts has done in her book, and it's something we've tried to kind of include in our lessons, is that more inquiry-based approach. But it's really evident that our curriculum is working in what our students are able to say, how they can articulate themselves, but also what they're able to do with new information that's presented to them about unfamiliar places.
I've seen quite a lot on X recently criticising inquiry learning, and I find it... I don't start arguing, but you've just very eloquently described why it's such a wonderful way of drawing geographical understanding out of students from prior learning, because it draws in so many different aspects that make for Margaret Roberts' perfect lesson, where you use a piece of geographical data or you use a map or you use a photograph, but it's underpinned by geographical thinking.
I think it has to be used with caution. I think the way that I use it is kind of a way into thinking about a topic, and it definitely doesn't replace teacher exposition and kind of the teacher being the expert in the room. I think there needs to be a balance between inquiry and sort of teacher-led learning to ensure that misconceptions are not kind of gained by students. And for me, that activity, I use mini whiteboards as a really low stakes way for students to record what they'd learned and what they were discussing with their partner. And by walking around the room, I was very easily able to just kind of glance and see, okay, are there any misconceptions at this point that I need to address? What sorts of things are they able to draw on, or what kind of more knowledge might I need to reinforce before they're ready to interpret this landscape and before I then give them more information and context about the geographies of this particular area? So what I would say is I think inquiry-based learning, there has to be a balance between that and more teacher-led learning in order for students to be successful and make progress. But I think it can be a really powerful tool if students are set up well to know how to do it well. I can imagine if I'd have given that to my year 10s a few years ago when they hadn't done our kind of redesign Key Stage 3, they would have really struggled with that task and probably wouldn't have been able to make anything reasonable from it in terms of inferences. So I think you have to set them up well for success. And part of that comes down to the explicit mapping of the skills and the knowledge that they need to be able to access the learning and to be able to do that task effectively.
Yeah, I'd just add that I think some people willfully misunderstood it as being some sort of finding out from nothing really. Inquiry is a discipline process. That's the point. It's inducting students into the discipline. And part of that is their ability to find out geographical information from a range of sources like maps, graphics, images, and so forth. So it's about asking questions, but it's also about finding out information and understanding the world better as a result.
I want to come back to a point you made, Luke, because it's an interesting one. When you're on your own, the assessment methods that you use have to be determined by how much time you've got with the rest of your life thinking about that. You've got to be thinking about which are the most effective in terms of not sucking up too much of my time, methods of assessment, but also which are the most effective for my students as well. And there's a balance there because you've said you've got 120 Y7s. So how do you meet that challenge?
It's all about curriculum, progression and assessment, all working in unison. So in terms of my curriculum, what are they learning? What's that underlying skill we're going towards? Is there a point of me giving them a really detailed report to write here? Or is it more about they know and understand these key ideas as a starting point? And it's matching your assessment with what you want them to get out of that unit. So, for example, in Year 7, if we're talking about those fundamental building blocks, we'll be looking at that knowledge, that understanding. Do they know and do they understand these concepts? But as I move perhaps through into Year 8 and Year 9, it's going to be a lot more about can they apply that knowledge in perhaps different contexts, or can they start to articulate their ideas in a more coherent way rather than them just knowing stuff. Knowing stuff's great, but unless you can use that knowledge, unless you can apply it to different contexts, you're not going to get that inquiry through geography. You're not going to be thinking like a geographer does. And that's where you have to be very skillful in picking out your assessments. What assessment best fits what I want them to be able to do at the end? So obviously at GCSE, it's an exam. You can talk about the merits of it and the problems with it, but we know where the end goal is. But in that exam, there are different styles of questions. There's different things they're looking for, different key ideas they're going to try and exploit using different question types. And it's also understanding your GCSE exams and going, looking at them and going, okay, this is sort of one of the end goals. We've got to start to move that backwards as well. So your multiple choice questions, they come up in GCSE questions as well. That's ticked off, but perhaps thinking about your more 6-8 mark questions about knowledge or understanding or your application of that knowledge and understanding to perhaps an unfamiliar or different example, where are you building that through in terms of the assessments you're doing as well? So it's all about everything being in balance. It's not just going, oh, we're going to make everything a presentation, because it's really easy for me to sit there and go, yes, 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 there you go, highlight the sheet, give it back to them in a lesson whilst they're doing it. It's about going, that's a good technique, but it needs to be balanced with everything else I'm trying to reach. And it's just balancing out your curriculum, knowing what you want them to achieve, making sure they're making the progress on it, and then that final sort of long-term goal of balancing in what you're going to have at GCSE, what you're going to have at the big end point that you're coming towards.
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on something there, which is about fitness for purpose. And one of the reasons I think geographers have gotten a right muddle about this is getting dragged into doing summative assessment over frequently, if not all the time. Whereas what our framework tries to do is to remind people that just as with the curriculum, there's a sort of short-term time scale, and that's rather different from the medium term over it. Probably over your little work and the long-term time scale, so that the practices at each time scale are going to be different and they have to be manageable. So the majority of the assessment information in, from day to day is going to come from interactions with the students in the classroom through formative assessment. Very little need to pin that down over frequently, whereas in the long term, it's much more likely to be formalised and graded in some sort of way. And in a sense, that's one of the features of our guidance, which goes right back to the early days of national curriculum, is that, to try and distinguish those different timescales, the different focus for each one, and the different practices which underpin them.
Catherine, what did Ofsted say about your assessment practices? Were you happy by the time they came in that you'd set them up as you wanted them? And what were their views on what you do?
I would say we were definitely still undergoing a period of transition. I'd been in post for 2 months when they came in, so there was a limit as to kind of the practical aspects that we managed to put in place. But I think because everything was so clearly underpinned by our intent, because we'd mapped out our core organising concepts really clearly in terms of how we were going to progress those in each unit of work, then even if the assessment, you know, the summative assessment, if we're going to kind of be crude about sort of how we're measuring it in the sort of longer term sense of kind of our students making progress, even though those assessments weren't necessarily all in place at that particular point in time throughout our entire key stage, we were able to articulate exactly how we were assessing formatively on the day to day and how we intended to kind of assess more summatively, either at the end of units of work. And our school has an end of key stage or an end of year assessment for each student as well, which kind of draws through all the learning from earlier in that academic year. So yeah, there were lots of opportunities for us to really develop something interesting from that and to kind of have some really interesting conversations. I was asked a series of questions in the deep dive around my implementation. So how are we sure that our curriculum was working? And I think measuring impact, assessment, obviously formatively and summatively together, are one of the mechanisms you can use for kind of assessing how successfully you are achieving what you set out to achieve with your students. So yeah, at the point when Ofsted came in, obviously that was still very much in its infancy, but I was able to clearly articulate exactly where we were going with that. On the day-to-day, they asked me things like, how do we support students to retain new information? And that was kind of, like I said, with the multiple choice quizzes, we'd introduced that at this point, we'd seen some tangible impact from that at that particular point in time. So we were able to talk about the short-term assessment. And for us, that's very low stakes. We never collect the scores on that for students. It's very much a self-assessment opportunity of, do I know this? Do I need to go back and look at it? And it was part of a wider drive across school for kind of metacognition and thinking about retrieval practices and being more explicit about that in our curriculum planning as well. I think what's really important as well is they did ask me about the impact of COVID-19 and how did I know that I'd successfully plugged gaps in knowledge and understanding following that as well. So that was an interesting conversation because I was able to talk about how moving our curriculum forwards ensured that students had the foundation to move on with whatever level of study they were at. So assessment was a huge part of that. But again, it's all comes back to do with the thinking behind your curriculum and the sequencing of learning, and then just kind of being able to demonstrate that impact through how we're doing that through assessment, but also through pupil voice. We're getting really big on sort of, you know, what are students saying about our curriculum? Like, what are they able to articulate to us in terms of what they feel they have learned? Is that what we set out to achieve with them, or have they learned something different in their perception of it? So we're sort of trying to triangulate now that sort of summative assessment data and the formative assessment data we have with the student voice, and also kind of looking and reviewing students' work. Like, what are they actually able to do on the day to day? What are they able to do when it comes to assessment in terms of responding to different types of questions or different types of tasks? Like Luke said, you know, it might be a decision-making task, it might be a piece of extended writing, as opposed to a set of traditional questions with kind of different levels of marked responses. So I think those things were all taken into account in the conversation I had with Ofsted. And I think I was able to clearly explain the direction of travel, even though I didn't have all those things in place. And that was something that was really important to that conversation.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about the latest subject report from Ofsted in England is that assessment is both formative and summative is one of the emerging strengths for the subject, which is actually a first in the 30-year series of Ofsted geography reports. So that's a bravo to everybody, and it'd be nice to think that the GA had some sort of impact on that.
We've spent a lot of time talking about the one publication, and a very important one for teachers, that the special interest group has been involved with. But what else does the special interest group do? It's been around for a long time, and it's been supporting teachers for a long time.
We try and have one long-term project, of which this has been, this guidance has been one example. We have some annual, sort of cycle of annual activities, such as Catherine's conference workshop and our guidance, which comes out late August, early September, about the GCSE and A-level exam results. And then we also undertake other smaller projects, sometimes we publish those in the magazine. So in teaching geography or primary geography most often. But we will be looking out for a new long-term project fairly soon, I think. The other thing I should mention is that we're always looking out for new members. And the way to go about that is to contact Luke or come up and say hello to somebody from the group at the GA conference, or message us via headquarters.
I think the most interesting thing for me, because I delivered the GA, the Special Interest Groups GA conference session last year, and there was so much appetite for further discussions and for collaboration. I think we're very lucky to be part of a very collaborative subject association with the Geographical Association, where there is so much appetite for people to want to develop and progress and to do the best for their pupils in whatever setting they're in. And I think having delivered that session, so last year, David Gardner and I delivered a session on planning for progress. David gave the theory and the theoretical side of it from his research and from what he's writing about. And what was really great about that is then I was able to provide the school context of how I then implemented that in my school setting. And I think, like I said, that's the real value of our group, is you've got sort of the experience and the theory, and then you've got kind of practicing teachers and subject leaders who are then kind of implementing that and reflecting on the process of doing that. And I think following that session, the amount of discussions I've had with various people who were in my position of saying, you know, I'm a subject leader, I'm in the same position as you, and that I'm trying to redesign my Key Stage 3 curriculum, I'd love to kind of collaborate more and understand more about how you did that. I think there's so much appetite for those discussions. And this year at the GA conference, we're doing a session on the national data in terms of GCSE and A-level data for geography, and how you can use that to interpret what's going on in your school setting and to inform your curriculum practice. So we really, you know, do welcome these conversations with lots of different people. And I think the appetite out there for that collaboration really reflects the fact that the group is really well placed to be able to open that dialogue and to kind of welcome lots of different people in lots of different scenarios to join that conversation and to work together to move forwards.
Yeah, and the other thing is we're always looking out for new examples of good practice to kind of help support the membership.
Luke, I'm going to give you the final word. Anything to add?
I think we've got lots of stuff perhaps to look at the national data, such as why is it that our highest awarded grade is a grade 3? The good old CD borderline still there, still hanging around. I think there is a lot of work to be done, perhaps looking at equality, diversity in the assessments and examinations more generally, in terms of examples used, places, how they portrayed in the exams. And I think there's definitely going to be more changes in terms of national curriculum, and we're reaching sort of perhaps the end of these examinations, specifications, life cycles, and have no doubt probably in the next 3 or 4 years, they're all going to get rewritten again, and the cycle will therefore repeat and we'll all go back to sort of stage one again.
That's a fairly desperate thought. I was hoping to finish on a nicer one than that. Listen, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you three about this. It's such an interesting but complex and difficult subject. Without being able to share it with other people, I feel for you, Luke. I think I'm glad you're able to find that sort of sharing, and being part of the Geographical Association is so valuable, particularly for teachers on their own, I think. But it has been absolutely fascinating listening to the three of you talking about the work of the Special Interest Group. Thanks for joining me today. Thank you.
Thanks for hosting. Bravo, everybody.